This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
That's... Yeah, they have asked for that, really.
Well, you can laugh. It was the World Cup.
I'm a little bit of an idealist, but having said that, I want to be like me.
You don't know what you're talking about.
When did you know that?
I managed to stay alive for 6 days.
I'm going to leave it there.
I'd say it to your face, and I'll say it to you now.
I'm going down to Anfield and we'll see them, won't we?
What you doing down here, you shawnee man?
The greatest team in the history of the Premier League, humbled in spectacular fashion by an injury-decimated, newly promoted club that spent less than £4 million on new signings in the summer and has been leaking goals for fun. As Premier League narratives go, well, let's be having you. Well done to Norwich City. Welcome to Monday Second Captain's Football Podcast. Owen here, back from holidays and excited beyond words to rekindle my working relationship with my colleagues and dear friends, Murph and Ken. Hi, Ken and Murph.
Hey, Ken.
Owen.
Hey, Owen.
But I haven't had a chance to listen back to the podcast over the last couple of weeks. Has this been going on where
no,
Ken calls
no.
Owen and all that? No.
No.
You've made up for really. That by making that mistake now.
God, it's a good start of the week.
That hasn't happened before.
Yeah, I know. I mean, usually me, Owen. Yeah. But anyway, listen. On we go.
Yeah.
No
I'm
point
Owen.
On the mistakes.
Okay, I'm Owen, you're Murph.
Time
he's
to just
Ken. We're ready
get
to go.
Into the, attack the week, Owen. That's
yeah,
always my motto.
That's what it's all about.
Yep. How'd you get on, Owen? You were in like grungy, sort of twilighty Pacific Northwest.
Did you say grunge?
Yes,
Ken, I did
Seriously,
spend.
Ken.
I did spend the last couple
just
of weeks.
Be better than that.
In the fine city of Seattle. I know, look, I don't want to scare our listeners. I'm not going to guarantee there'll be a grunge week 2019.
It won't be.
Or will there be? Look, it wasn't a very grungy holiday, I got to be honest with you. We had the young lad over there meeting my wife's sister's baby. So I wasn't spending much time socialising around the old haunts of Kurt Cobain or Eddie Vedder or the likes, or Chris Cornell for that matter. In fact, the whole trip passed off almost entirely grunge-free until I walked into a bookshop and stumbled upon this book. Everybody Loves Our Town, I've brought it in here, guys. An oral history of grunge featuring Nirvana, Pearl Jam, Soundgarden, Alice in Chains and more. Murph literally has his hands over his mouth here. 20 years after the release of Nirvana's Nevermind and Pearl Jam's 10 comes the definitive word on Seattle's grunge era, drawn from more than 250 new interviews. 250 new interviews and featuring previously untold stories and never before published photographs. Everybody Loves Our Town captures the era in the words of the musicians, etc., etc. The book tells the whole story, Ken, from the founding of the Deep Six bands to the global success of grunge's Big Four, who are, of course, Murph. I've just already said them.
Soundgarden, Nirvana, Pearl Jam, and Mudhoney.
Alice in Chains, Ken. Right. From the rise of Seattle's...
I can't believe we're doing this again.
We should definitely release a patrons, members only...
Non-grunge era.
Oh,
from the rise of Seattle's indie label Sub Pop to the major label feeding frenzy that followed, from the joy of making noise in basements and tiny rock clubs to the tragic deaths of Superstar.
I mean, if you're not paying for this, then you know, I suppose you're just gonna have to suck it up. But if you're paying for this, you shouldn't have to be mad listening.
By turns, moving, funny, lurid, and insightful, Everybody Loves Our Town is the authoritative portrait of an extraordinary musical era. So how about this, guys, right? You know, as a sort of a compromise.
How about you read that book and then bore your wife to tears with developments that you've read in it, but then leave us out of it.
I read this entire 567-page oral history and regale you guys with all the amazing yarns from the glory days of the greatest musical era in history. Sound good? Instead of playing out all, you know, playing out with songs that we've already played twice over. Let's be honest, we've probably exhausted that particular musical canon at this point. Don't know if there are any good songs left to play. So, no, you don't want me to read this.
He's as bold as a pig.
You can read away, but, you know.
Oral histories, they're always very long.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's my literary comment for the day. Okay, I've got some actual news to bring you.
A whole new way of doing journalism. It's brilliant.
I don't know what you're talking about.
It is some big live event news, to be specific. Over the course of the next week, strictly on the Second Captain's World Service, we'll be announcing two events that are exclusive to our members. One is a live screening of Ireland versus Japan in the World Cup on the 28th of September, followed by a live recording of the Second Captain's podcast. It'll be the first time we've ever recorded a morning show that hasn't taken place in a tent outside Tyke Furlong's uncle's pub on Whitty Island. And it promises to be even more fun than that memorable occasion.
So cheers.
Come and watch that with us. Rob won't be there, obviously. He'll be entertaining you in a more direct way. Secondly, as you may know, Richie X5 Sad Sadler will be releasing his book, Recovering, in a beautiful little venue called the Chocolate Factory in Dublin in early October. This book is going to blow everybody away. We'll be recording a live show at the official launch, and all tickets go to Second Captain's World Service members. It'll be a special night, and at Richie's request, it'll be full with our much-loved members. Those two announcements will be made in full this week on the World Service with full details. So if you want to be at either event, you need to become a member at secondcaptains.com before tomorrow. Now, let's report on some sport, please, Ken.
So I suppose we should speak about the Arsenal, Aaron.
Yeah.
Things had been looking good in some ways for Arsenal. You know, they had that defeat against Liverpool. But, you know, there was promising signs. Unfortunately, a lot of things unraveled against Watford yesterday. People will talk about David Luiz.
They will, Ken.
I would say that, you know, he is some man for one man, but he's still only one man. You've got a team there. I see Duncan Alexander of Opta tweets that Arsenal have faced 96 shots this season, more than any other side in the Premier League, Serie A, La Liga, Ligue 1, and the Bundesliga. Some effort, that. Against Watford, they were outshot 31-7. 31.
I saw that match of the day too last night, and I was like, well, that's obviously
31 shots.
Yeah.
That's Ireland against Liechtenstein in 95 territory.
Yes.
It'll be a Watford actually hit the back of the net.
Yes, and so they have to, they really have
subtle
to.
Subtle shade being thrown on Tony Cascarino there, but continue again.
Thank the finishing of Aubameyang for rescuing them anything from this match. Really a disaster. It's kind of like, How can they have done so badly in this game? You know, people will talk about David Luiz. He did give away a penalty, and he's now given away two penalties in four matches for Arsenal after giving away 360 for Chelsea. So he's conceding penalties at, what is it, like 30 times the rate, thereabouts. You know, I don't see him keeping it up.
But it's indicative of the pressure that he feels, that he's under now, compared to when he was in a team like Chelsea, which was organised defensively.
Well, you got to play.
It's
like,
just not even David Luiz's fault that he's given away two penalties.
Well, you've got Kante, you know, in the Chelsea team, you know, and what do they have at Arsenal? Xhaka. Xhaka, who comes out and says, we were scared in the second half. We have to show more character and not be scared. Is this Graeme Souness or the Arsenal captain? Who, you know, nobody wanted the ball. Every team in the Premier League is strong enough to score. You have to stay calm, be mentally strong. We weren't today, says Souness / Xhaka. Just echoing Souness was on TV talking about how the proper teams don't do this. I think proper team is good and an improper team, such as Arsenal, is bad. But Xhaka, it sounds like he agrees. It's as though it had nothing to do with him. This insanely porous team. You know, Aubameyang apparently said on Canal Plus, presumably speaking en français, I feel like we are literally giving goals to the opposition. That's how he's not I don't accuse anyone. You could say that us, the attackers, could have killed the game off, scored a third goal. I'm not going to say it's someone's fault. But obviously we didn't expect that. So I think, what that game yesterday with Arsenal was tremendously reassuring game for teams like Chelsea and Manchester United. You know, in the sense that, these guys don't look that serious.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It seems as though the top two is probably out of reach for everybody apart from the top two. Tottenham, are kind of still in there, and I guess fancy before the season and had for the first time a good win over the weekend. But, Chelsea and Man United have the ambitions to finish in the top four, and this is a sign that it's not necessarily the impossible task, especially, I would say, for Chelsea, who are currently enjoying their greatest ever era.
Huh? How so?
Well, just this whole transfer ban thing. I remember when we were talking about Chelsea at the start of the season saying, this is actually maybe not such a bad thing for Chelsea. You know, given that they've got all of these, they've been running this massive youth football operation for many years. In fact, which eventually resulted in them getting banned from signing players because of the way they were doing it. But having to actually use some of these players might actually work out well. And okay, it's just what I think is interesting about it is Chelsea have scored 11, conceded 11. All the 11 goals have been scored by young England players. And apart from, I think there was an own goal in there. But this is way more enjoyable for fans than apparently winning the league with Jose was.
Eight points from five games.
Yeah. Mm. A 4-0 hammering at Old Trafford. And yet, this is really what it's... At last, 16 years into the Roman Abramovich era, we have finally...
We've got a proper team.
The purpose of Chelsea.
This is a different kind of proper team in the Sunnis.
Stitched up by European authorities, shunned by commerce, forced to turn inward for solutions. Chelsea, once hive of international mercenaries, are now champions of England's hearts. Mm. What is the Chelsea club motto? I was wondering, because carefree is kind of a Chelsea word. You know, if it was like the House of Chelsea, their words would it be carefree? Well, actually, that's kind of an unofficial one. Apparently, they did used to have an official Latin motto, mm-hmm.
Which along the lines of Murph's. What was your motto from earlier? There, you already forgotten it.
I had a proper team.
No, you started this show with you blurted out a motto. Clearly, it's not one that's that close to your heart. If you can't
attack
remember.
The weak,
attack the weak. Is that
Chelsea? In Latin? No, Chelsea's motto. And of course, attack the weak.
The Latin for attack the weak is.
Of course. No, I can't. I've interrupted you enough.
Chelsea's Latin motto is Nisi Dominus Frustra.
Don't get too frustrated.
Don't frustrate the homeowner.
No.
That's much better.
No, it's unless God be with us, all is in vain. All will be in vain. Except the Lord build the house, they labor in vain that build it. It is often inscribed on buildings, apparently. Ah. It's from it's from.
So basically, you don't frustrate the homeowner. That's basically. I mean,
no. It's. I mean, the meaning is clear. I mean, it's as though it actually seems quite an appropriate motto for what Frank Lampard is building at Chelsea. Without God, it's all for nothing, in it. Essentially, what they're saying, it's a little bit redolent of Gott mit uns and other such. Mottos. But, it has apparently fallen into disuse at Chelsea. And I just wonder if maybe a new motto should be coined Unus Ex Nostra. Which is,
one
of course,
time.
One of our own. Owen. Frank Lampard had a couple of pints with the academy staff to thank them for producing so many of these new
Some
star
jelly
players.
Deals. That's more East End of London. Well, what kind of West End?
What pints was he having? Like, was he having some over fizzed, over chilled continental lager, or was it, good thick, creamy, warm pints of ale. Bellies full of English ale. This is, you know, good warm fermented pints. I mean, you know, you could sort of pick holes and say, well, Chelsea are conceding a lot of goals. You know, I mean, you know, Matt Doherty, I think Wolves won 2-1 in the time that Matt Doherty was on the field. I think Adama Traore, who has been playing in Doherty's stead since Doherty's been injured at Everton, I think showed some of the good things that he can do, also some of the bad things against Chelsea. It was mainly the bad things in terms of, whoop, you know, should I be doing something here to try to stop them scoring? When Doherty came on, he seemed to shore them up a bit and indeed helped to force their second goal. I mean, you could nitpick and you could say, you know, Chelsea had switched to three at the back. Is this actually the kind of system that David Luiz might have suited? But I think that would be to miss the point about what's really happening here, which is Chelsea emerging onto the sunlit uplands. They're at the sunlit uplands now. The sky is ablaze. Whether it be the bright rays of the dawn sun or a thermonuclear explosion just over the horizon, only time will tell. Mm-hmm. But right now, it seems as though this is like, you know, it's like autarky is the way forward. It's like, so the England's green and pleasant land is in bloom.
What is the way forward, did you say?
Autarky. Oh, and self-reliance. You know, you don't want to worry about the rest of the world. To hell with the rest of the world. All that matters is, you know, grow your own garden. And Chelsea's garden sprouts forth. It's like a new agricultural revolution, a new football. They're even exporting players, you know, outproducing everybody in Europe, exporting players. I mean, there's this Emil Heskey. Emil Heskey's also got a book out, actually, but he's doing some interviews about it, and he talks about Jadon Sancho. English football and Gareth will end up owing a debt to Jadon Sancho. A lot of young players are looking for someone to make a break for it and leave a big club to play first team football. If he'd stayed at City, would he be in Pep Guardiola's first team? Maybe. Would he be in the England side? No. Now he's an integral part of this national squad. He's not far behind Marcus Rashford, if he is behind him. But it's thanks to the risk Jadon took. He went out on a limb. I mean, in one level, this is kind of funny, like in the sense of the idea that going to Borussia Dortmund to be like a first team player for Borussia Dortmund was like a risk. You know what I mean? Like, it was actually an amazing move. You know, it's not like he was going to play in some sort of obscure league or, you know, I hope that I'm going to join FC Twente and hope that they break up the Ajax PSV Feyenoord thing and get into the Champions League and get attention that way. It's like he's playing for one of the major clubs in Europe and actually getting the team. When it happened, people were looking at him, Sasseki, thinking, what's he done that for? Or he must be a troublemaker. He backed himself. He backed his talent. Now it's paying off for him. Young players now want to go out to Germany or France because they have a chance to play. So he mentions the likes of Phil Foden, Callum Hudson-Odoi, and how they're not, you know, they're not getting any, not a look. I mean, to be fair, Callum Hudson-Odoi does have a injured Achilles at the moment, which will be limiting his minutes, even if, I'm sure that Frank Lampard would probably be looking at using him if it wasn't for the fact that he can't actually, you know, run.
Yeah.
But that's what Eski's saying.
But it is a legitimate point. I know you're saying it shouldn't be that surprising that a young, if you take it out of football, that a young person who's is very good at their job gets an exciting offer from overseas. I mean, actually, in a lot of walks of life, you jump at it. This is pretty exciting, whatever age he was when he went over. But it hasn't happened generally in football. The players who move abroad from England are at different stages, sometimes towards the end of their career when they're big names, back in the 80s and 90s, trying to make a bit of cash when there was more money elsewhere. Then probably more recently, when it hasn't worked out oftentimes, later on in their career, that's when you go to Portugal or Spain, whatever it might be, and have a go. But so the young superstars don't normally do this. So.
No.
It is kind of new, I think.
Yeah. I mean, I wonder if have City been criticized enough for selling Jadon Sancho? You know, I mean, there's no, you can't really, it's kind of stupid in one way to go, oh, hang on, this guy you sold is really good. You know, you're an idiot. Yeah. Although it didn't stop people such as me doing it when, for instance, Jose Mourinho sold Kevin De Bruyne or, you know, to a lesser extent, Mohamed Salah. You know, they did sort of throw away a guy who would be pretty useful to them right now. You know, especially as they've lost Leroy Sané. I mean, so they lost to Norwich, and this, it's kind of clear that, I mean, when Laporte got injured, myself and yourself, Kieran, I think we were talking about this at the time, saying this is really bad. You know, they don't have a player who can cover for him. They don't have someone who can replicate what he does. So even though you've got this great squad and, you know, great style of play and, you know, they're a machine, this is like, the machine is breaking down. When you lose Sané and Laporte, City are kind of a left-sided dominant team. And the reason for that is because Laporte is the defender who's the best passer. You know, he is when he's not injured. And, you know, that the entire sort of architecture of that side has now disintegrated. And they're trying to have to find a way through. And then the fact is they're conceding stupid goals. I mean, Norwich, you know, Guardiola after the game was full of, you know, as a manager, all I can do is try and make sure my team shoots more and concedes less shoots. And that's what happened. I mean, again, City had, I think, 25 attempts on goal, 8 on target. Norwich had 3 attempts on target, and all of them went in the net. But we hear a little bit of Guardiola. Here he is just taking issue with some of the internet meme artists who've been, who he claims not to have been paying any attention to over the last few years.
When the first season, it was Frau Guardiola, Frau Diola, okay? So, and this kind of game here in England is not possible to play because here we need tackles, they had to play that. These players gave me the prestigious I have. And all around the world, how good manager I am. So it's for them, not for me, it's for them. If in that moment, when they don't care, lose the game, when they don't care absolutely anything in that situation, I would be a problem. But I know how they suffer, because in the past, when they don't win, don't do that. What do you do? What do you have to do? Work harder, work more, talk more, be more precise, and start to winning games and winning games and winning games. And at the end, we are not able, we congratulate the opponent.
Yeah, Frau Guardiola, what did he say? I hope he knows that it was like Fraudiola and not like Mrs. Guardiola in German.
I think so.
There's just a little bit more of Guardiola here. I mean, his mood, obviously, it wasn't tip-top after this.
So we are in September. We're going to do that. Okay, congratulations, Liverpool, you are the champion. We're in September. What do we have to do?
Yes, so he, you know.
It is the biggest gap at the top of the Premier League in the history of the Premier League after 5 games.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
I mean, it's record-breaking.
You're saying City can't turn it around?
Well, Liverpool are on track to what he's saying.
Well, no, City win all their games, including 2 wins over Liverpool, then they will win the league by a point.
True. It's still in their hands for now.
It is still in their hands. But they can't afford any more slip-ups on.
Liverpool are currently on track to win this league by 38 points.
Yeah. The numbers don't lie, you know?
It has been said that when they finally do it, it could end up being, it won't be anticlimactic for Liverpool fans, but it could end up being just that they end up going away in a procession.
You'd have to say that winning the league by 38 points would
38
be
points would be, yeah, that would be anticlimactic.
Wrapped up by January.
Surely Liverpool fans could be happy with that.
Well, it is. It's an interesting situation because it does now look, I mean, with it being 5 points clear of City and 7 clear of all the other teams, I mean, to be after 5 matches, at least 2 clear wins ahead of Tottenham, for instance, is a big lead. I mean, they're going to be, it looks as though they'll be in the lead for a few weeks at least. So they've got plenty of time to sort of get used to this position and then also to start thinking about the ways that it could go wrong.
Yeah. But on the flip side, this weekend's result notwithstanding, Spurs, is anyone really counting them into this title race?
Well, you don't know. I mean, again, it's like it's about what Tottenham were able to do last season is remain as a kind of a contender for the Premier League, even though they were losing a lot of matches just by winning all the matches they didn't lose up until, you know, about February when they finally just started to lose almost every second game and okay, it stopped. But you know, you can keep in there as long as you sort of don't draw too many matches. You know, I mean, Liverpool at the moment look really strong, but I do think the balance has been tilted towards them because of the because of random events in the form of injuries to Sané and Laporte, you know, if it was Van Dijk and Mané who were the players who were who had been ruled out for 6 months, I think we'd all be sitting here going, well, this is finished. Mm. Five games in, it really would be finished. And instead, it's City that have suffered the injuries and thus others who have the chance. I do wonder, though, if City, are they missing a trick here in terms of the young English player endorphin dividend, which they're ignoring? I mean, okay, sure, they've got Raheem Sterling and John Stones. Yesterday's news, right? What about tomorrow's
old man news? Sterling?
Yeah.
Well, John Stones might actually be yesterday's news. By his performance the weekend.
But, you know, Phil Foden, you know, what does this guy have to do? You know, we've seen Chelsea. We've seen Manchester United. English stars. British stars. Maguire. Wan-Bissaka. You know,
McTominay.
The Union. You know, the actual Union. Too much, certainly.
You just need the next Sammy McElroy to include the... complete the set for United.
Too much for Leicester City. I mean, I don't know if you saw the game. It wasn't a great game, really.
Unfortunately, I didn't see it, but I do know one man who was paying very close attention.
Oh, you were watching it with David Moyes.
Well, it's the face of Premier Sports One.
Are we still counting? Are we counting Daniel James as English?
British, Owen. Union.
No, because I thought you said English.
No. In this case,
that might be a bit of a stretch.
Manchester United are.
I was born in Hull, I suppose.
Well, you know.
I was watching watching Manchester United Leicester with in the company of David Moyes.
Was he excited?
Well, he wasn't like many watching. Ken, he wasn't blown away by Manchester United's performance levels. I mean, they didn't really do anything of note after about midway through the first half. They played reasonably well early on. Solskjaer talked about it afterwards as though they were the greatest. How could you not be entertained by that opening 20 minutes? You know, I was like, well, yeah, it was better than the last 70.
Yeah.
But they weren't great. Neither were Leicester, for that matter.
No, they weren't. Leicester were quite disappointing, weren't they? Because, you know, there was...
A lot of hype about Leicester.
Because United were missing, obviously, Pogba. You know, there was
Martial, Lingard, there's a few of them out.
Yes. Yeah. And Leicester are kind of in good form, and oh, you know, maybe can Leicester take the next step, and it just didn't happen for them, you know. I see Rodgers talking afterwards about Madison, another of the new wave, as comparing him to Coutinho. It's kind of like, get a grip, like, what are you talking about? You know,
he was pretty good, though. I mean, if you watched Premier Sports Cover, you would have seen the post-match package that David Moyes and Cunningham put together to highlight his outstanding contributions.
He's good, but, like, let's not get carried away. Like, I mean, Rodgers sitting there, he has big potential, says Rodgers, in his kind of Portuguese-inflected way that he talks about.
In this moment.
He's big football, and he's in a good moment.
Yeah.
But, you know, he's a really humble boy who has a lovely swagger and a lovely arrogance. Like, what is this word salad like? He's a really humble boy with lovely arrogance. It makes no sense. I mean, James Maddison does not strike me, by the way, for a second, as a humble boy.
He was a lot. It wasn't James Maddison who was on top of a Porsche or something in the summer.
Oh, God.
Yeah. I think it was a football.
He was involved in an altercation outside a nightclub as well, which revolved, I think, around the words, "Don't you know who I am?"
Oh, no, really. Well, look, I humility isn't the first quality that I'm reminded of when I see James Maddison on the field, which is not a bad thing. You know, I think he's a pretty decent player, but Rodgers talking about him as sort of Coutinho. Well, we didn't really see it. We didn't really see it the other day. I mean, Pogba was missing for Manchester United, and they did, you know, there's this question with Pogba as to whether that's... you know, is it a surprise that when you take him out of the team, suddenly Manchester United appear very kind of brainless and unable to create anything? Mm-hmm. You know, is that something that maybe should be remarked upon? I mean, they obviously Rashford managed to get the goal from the penalty, and maybe Pogba not being there simplified that situation. But in terms of creating chances from play, it didn't really happen. And this is, I think, what happens in his absence. Not that this has deterred Gary Neville. I don't know if you've seen... his latest smack mouth quotes on this.
No.
I think he's talking to Norwegian TV, I think. Pogba wants to leave. He's made it clear. His agent is a disgrace and has been a disgrace all over Europe, not just for Manchester United. They must stop working with him. He doesn't have the values you want in your club. Manchester United need not negotiate with him. He'll try to fix the transfer for his player and will try to take part of the transfer sum himself. That's how he operates. For Manchester United, it's devastating. Pogba's one of the best and most famous players in the world. Every week there are new issues. There's always controversy. It's probably not his own fault, but the fact that it is devastating for a club. That's why Sir Alex Ferguson was at times clinical when he got rid of players. It's a football club. Everyone has to go in the same direction. So I don't know if he seems to be urging Solskjaer to get rid of Pogba just because he doesn't like Raiola. But again, when you see the way that they were without him, maybe that's one of the reasons why they're kind of dragging their heels on that. Maybe there's some way this situation might turn around. I mean, who knows? Maybe
he's quite a talented footballer.
You never know. I mean, yeah.
It's a Lamborghini. My apologies to everybody at Porsche and Lamborghini. Also, I don't know why he's on top of the Lamborghini, because he's actually promoting his football boots and not a car. Mm. He's sitting on top of a Lamborghini with his new boots. There's a few other photos. Believe the hype. At Puma Football. This is my flow. Hashtag new levels. Hashtag Puma 1. There he is again. Showing it. A couple of shots just outside driving the car, sitting outside the car, but then one literally sitting on top of the car holding his lovely new boots. There he is, on top of his Lamborghini.
Is that his Lamborghini?
Well, it's a Lamborghini.
Yeah.
I mean, I presume it's. Why wouldn't it be his?
He's absolutely. Yeah. Well, congratulations to him. He's got a lovely swagger.
Yeah, a lovely arrogance.
What else? Obviously Liverpool won their match. Mane and Salah, friends again. Trent Alexander-Arnold done by a simple trick by Jethro Williams. I would say in his defence, I saw he was getting criticised a little bit for the way in which Liverpool conceded their first goal to Newcastle. I would say that if you looked up Jethro Williams on like Y Scout or one of these apps that lets you analyse what a player does on the field, I don't think you're going to find too many entries under the cuts onto weak foot and blast ball into top corner from 25 yards column. I think there's a new entry in that now, but I don't think there'd be lots of other entries. You know, when Alexander-Arnold, it sort of looked as though he obviously was kind of encouraging Williams to do what he did, but he just wasn't expecting. You're not going to expect a very left-footed player to suddenly unleash this type of damage.
From Ireland's second captain show. Second captain show.
It's the best thing in the world for you because it's full of protein. Protein.
This is not a dig at football people who know the game.
No respect, no honour.
Put your respect on my name.
Dog shit is bad, huh?
But who plays rugby?
I imagine it was like something you would expect to see in a porno movie.
No, they don't.
But they do.
Sorry, on. They do not.
And the balls.
Shut up, the two of you. I just want to play commentary at a goal.
Fall off and I'll go.
Fall off and I'll
go. Fuck you, can I guess?
Fuck you, can I guess?
I'm a little bit of an idealist, but having said that, I want to be like Nick.
You get the ball forward, you compete, you chase people, you close people down, you create excitement, you win balls when you shouldn't win balls, you commit yourself to the game.
Jonathan Wilson is with us this Monday, as is Sam Lee, the Athletic's Man City correspondent. So why don't we start with the most unlikely result of the Premier League season so far. 3 goals conceded, Sam, against an injury-ravaged Norwich City. I mean, this happened a couple of times last season, that rather freakish game against Palace. They conceded 3 goals, and there was the win, the 4-3 hollow victory in the second leg against Tottenham in the Champions League. But, you know, this shouldn't be happening. It certainly shouldn't be happening, I guess, against Norwich City.
Well, it shouldn't really. But I think fundamentally with those games, well, particularly the Tottenham one you mentioned and this one at the weekend, I think whenever people ask me what the best way is to approach a game against City, I've always said, or have said in the last year or so, pressure on the defensive midfielder, or at least try and get past the defensive midfielder, win it off them, or just try and bypass them and get straight at the centre-backs. And that's especially an issue, I think, when one of the centre-backs isn't Laporte, but particularly Otamendi. I think he's always been rash. Obviously, his biggest mistake on Saturday wasn't actually being exposed or put under pressure It was obviously the lack of concentration, lack of awareness, whatever you want to call it. But even his role in the second one, it was rash in the sense that he just pushed up on Stiefelman straight away. It was the bad decision, and that's pretty much what happens when Otamendi's put under pressure, when he's exposed, when he has to think about defending. And obviously with Laporte being out until the new year, that is going to be an issue that City are going to face quite a lot, especially with, I think Rodri's going to be not caught out a lot, but there will be times where people can get past him more easily than they would do if they were playing against Fernandinho, for example.
Yeah. I mean, we've seen Guardiola, Sam, acting how he deals with what he considers to be major mistakes in, say, the Amazon documentary. I mean, I can think of the example of Raheem Sterling missing like a sitter at Burnley or something. And Guardiola was extremely unforgiving about that kind of thing. He's like, you know, I think he substituted Sterling straight away. He's like, that's unacceptable. So how does he deal with a performance like Otamendi's?
I think it's difficult because, well, all these players, actually, Sterling as well, I think they've had issues with confidence too. I think it has become difficult because they've worked for so long together. And this is particularly the case for Stones. His confidence nosedives after not necessarily mistakes, but setbacks. And this is what I was trying to get at when I was asking Guardiola the other day. You know, I said, you've had poor results in the past and needed to recover, and you have. How have you gone about doing that? And he insisted they just talk. You know, they pinpoint things they should be doing better. I'll try to dig into more of the psychology side of it because I think that is particularly an issue for Stones. And I think for Otamendi too, because when he's good, he's very good. But when he's bad, he really is all over the place. How Guardiola deals with it, he's going to be in a bad mood. And he puts a brave face on in public. You know, he said there were some fundamentals of their performance that they did well, but it was just mistakes. But, you know, he was in a really bad mood after Tottenham. And they actually played well that day. I think that was probably their best performance of the season. But he was in a bad mood after that. He's going to be livid after this. It's good, I think, that they've got Shakhtar because they almost haven't got time to think. They'll be flying out today, maybe tomorrow morning. Guardiola will just show them the examples on the tape and say, look, you can't be doing this. This is what you need to do. I mean, stuff like the third goal is easily corrected. You would imagine even the first goal, the near post at corners would be easily corrected. But, you know, it became a problem a couple of years ago. It was last season and it seems to have gotten worse, which is interesting. Yeah. But I think the second one should be more easily avoided. But how he deals with them, I think it is just showing them the examples. You know, they're so reliant on video analysis and what they need to do and having all the tools to cope with what's going to be thrown at them. It will be that. But, I mean, the other question is whether people like Stones and Otamendi can be helped on kind of the mental side of things.
Yeah. Jonathan, I wonder what you made of the third goal. Obviously, it's a mistake by Otamendi. He could just pass it back to the goalkeeper. There's no need for them to concede a goal from that position. But, you know, there is something about this trend this season of playing little games of five-a-side directly in front of your own goal that seems unnecessarily risky. I mean, we saw Socrates for Arsenal conceding a goal from the same type of situation. Bulgaria against England the previous weekend, you know, we're trying to do this and it just was getting absolutely destroyed. What is your opinion about this trend? I mean, are you seeing a big payoff which sort of compensates for all of these pointless goals that we're seeing teams conceding from this risk-seeking behaviour?
Well, I think there was a payoff last season, the season before, when not many teams were doing it. It was an unusual thing, and I think opponents weren't really sure how do we respond to this. If they, you know, if a goalkeeper passes the ball to the fullback, you know, 5 yards from his own goal line, do we go and close him down, or is that going to leave us exposed behind? And I think teams, you know, were just baffled by that, what the right response was. What started to happen as we got more used to seeing teams do that, and obviously the change in the laws to, you know, defenders being allowed to touch the ball inside the box now, you know, as the first touch after a goal kick, so it sort of exacerbated that. Those passes are even shorter. But, you know, I think opponents now think, you know, we might as well press them because the chance of getting a, you know, an Otamendi figure, a sort of player who's not necessarily that deft on the ball, is not going to just sort of spin away from you and you know, suddenly you're out of the game. you know, there is a chance of suddenly just pinching a goal from nothing. And so, you know, it's that sort of cyclical thing of one team, you know, one means of playing sort of springs up, teams don't know how to deal with it, so it's successful, so a lot of teams start to do it, and then people begin to respond to that and realise, actually, you don't even have to press properly with that. You can just send two or three forwards, and that's kind of enough to create panic or you know, potentially, you know, just pinch a goal from nowhere. Where, and, you know, if you're Norwich playing a team like Manchester City, that might almost be your best chance of scoring. That and corners, obviously.
Well, yeah, the corners thing, Sam, is kind of crazy. You've both alluded to that. I guess it's impossible to build the perfect football team. And no matter how much money you have, you're going to have to sacrifice in some area, realistically. Has Pep just come to some sort of a sense of acceptance that the area in which they are going to be weaker than some other teams is defending set pieces? They're just not going to have as many 6'4" lads as some of the others.
Yeah, that's exactly it. He said it several times. He said it again at the weekend. You know, he said, you know, we've built our squad in such a way, you know, to have the technical quality of the players. He didn't say it specifically, but the obvious conclusion is they've sacrificed height for that. Rodri's a bit of an outlier because he's got all that technical ability and he was fantastic on the ball at the weekend. And he was generally good defensively, but obviously did get caught out for the second. But he's tall. So that's supposed to be a bit of a change for City. But yeah, you're right. They've generally got small technical players, and that does mean that the weaknesses are going to be set pieces. The way the City get around that generally is, well, they just try not to give the opposition any set pieces at all. And when they go away from home, they try to have more of the ball. They try to play further away from their own goal. And they try to restrict any corners or free kicks into the box whatsoever. If they do, Guardiola's made the point a couple of times this season, it's not just about height. It's about the aggressivity, the kind of mental approach, I think he called it, because he used Gundogan as the example last season when he was playing defensive midfield, because Fernandinho's not tall, but they really appreciate his heading ability. I mean, he's arguably the best header in the squad. I think he's about 5'10", maybe short, maybe 5'8". I've got that figure in my head. And he says, yeah, Gundogan, even he managed to do it last season because it's more of an attitude. And I think one of their small centre-backs said recently in an interview in Spain, there's things that he can do, you know, just in terms of, you know, little nudges and shoves and putting your body weight on them and this kind of thing. That's how you compensate for the lack of height. But again, if you look at it at the weekend, there wasn't really any kind of nous involved. You had three players stood still.
Yeah.
Kenny McLean just ran in and attacked it, free header.
Yeah.
Beat three men to it comfortably, and that was it. So there was no kind of nuance there. I asked Guardiola about it afterwards. I said, look, how much are you working on this? He said, every day, or almost every day. And I said, is it not frustrating that, you know, it seems to be getting worse? And he was like, well, look, in football, you can train for things. It doesn't mean it's going to happen that way. But again, going back to what he says in public and what he's like on the training ground, I would imagine he's going to be in an even worse mood than he has been for a long time, yeah, I'd imagine, after that Spurs game.
Just lastly, on these City sort of selections, Sam, and I want to bring you in on this, Jonathan, and hear what you think about it, is how much pressure is Guardiola under now to play Phil Foden? You know, I mean, he used Silva, Gundogan in midfield. They actually don't have great record when they start matches together. You know, if you look at the results of the games in which they've had them, okay, De Bruyne and Bernardo Silva are the first choice players. They're being rested because, you know, they played internationals. We understand that. But Foden is still on the bench. I get a sense that a lot of Man City fans want to see him in the team. And Guardiola kind of hypes him so much. I mean, he said, like, you know, he's the greatest player I've ever seen, you know, roughly that kind of thing. And yet it doesn't translate into minutes. So how is that situation developing?
Yeah, well, you're right. I did a column on this last week. And obviously Foden, he gave an interview after the England under-21s game last week, saying, you know, suggesting his frustration, saying, no, I just want to play, I'm ready to play. He gave one back in March as well, which was a bit more passive-aggressive than that as well. So he is frustrated about it. But on the flip side, he's not going to be pushing to leave because he's not just a City fan, but he doesn't really have the character like Sancho to go, right, I'm going to go and do it on my own, and I'm I don't mind moving to Germany to do it. Foden's not quite like that. So the situation from his point of view isn't critical yet. You mentioned the fans. You get the feeling the City fans want him to play, and that's absolutely right. I understand why Guardiola isn't playing him, not just so much protecting him, though that comes into it, because he was asked last season if there's a danger, I think it was those words, if there's a danger that Foden would miss the England squad for the Euros. And Guardiola said, well, maybe that will be a good thing. You know, we don't want people to be playing... We don't want young players to be playing too much football too young. So there's an element of protecting him. The other element is, how much pressure is Guardiola under to play him? From the club, not much, because Guardiola's there to win trophies. And if winning trophies means playing players that are better than Phil Foden, if they're more reliable than Foden in crucial moments of the game, making more sensible decisions, making decisions based on... you know, a wealth of experience of playing European football over the years, and in this case, it's going to be people like Gundogan, then he's going to pick people like Gundogan because they're just a safer bet, and Guardiola's judged on winning trophies within the club. He's not judged on bringing young players through.
But this is the point. Yeah,
the flip side of that does come after games like the weekend where Gundogan doesn't do anything, basically.
Yeah.
I tweeted about it after about 15 minutes. I was like, these are the games when people are going to be holding kind of the ghost of De Bruyne against Gundogan and saying, well, De Bruyne would be doing this, so what's the point?
Yeah.
And then then it comes to, if he's on and he's not doing it, then it might as well be Foden. And to be fair, I think I agree with that.
This is the thing, though, John. Now, what I find interesting about it, right, is if you contrast City, who are like this all-conquering best team in the world and so on, and the kind of grumbling of their supporters about this, compared to the euphoria... like the second summer of love that's currently happening at Stamford Bridge, right, where you've got this objectively not great team, it's just slugging it out with their opponents, scoring goals. They've scored 11, they've conceded 11.
That concession rate is the second worst in the Premier League, by the way. Yeah, only Norwich have conceded more.
Yeah. So. And yet everybody is just massively in love with this team. I mean, did you hear the stat that apparently all 11 of England's of Chelsea's goals have been scored by English under 21 players? This is the best thing that's happened to Chelsea. Breaking off a clean break with trade with the EU and everyone else has actually been the best thing that's ever happened to Chelsea. And there's a kind of a love in the air. I get the impression City fans are kind of looking at this and going, you know, why can't we have a Mason Mount? Foden could be our Mason Mount.
Well, I mean, if they are, they really shouldn't be. I mean, I was at Wolves on Saturday, and it was an extraordinary game. I don't think I've ever been at a game where, the sort of shifts in emotion in it was given that the scoreline didn't actually change that much. You know, Chelsea were winning for most of the game after what, half an hour, whatever it was, that the Tomori got the opener, and yet Wolves were terrible first half. So Chelsea are 3-0 up at half time, and it was the same as the Sheffield United game 2 weeks ago, that suddenly it was like at half time, it was as if Chelsea's opponents suddenly thought, actually they're not all that good. Let's get at them. And as soon as Wolves did, they conceded almost immediately on the break, but they battered Chelsea second half. And when there was the own goal from Abraham to make it 4-1, Wolves players were running to get the ball to take it back to the halfway line to get the game started again, because they thought they could get back into it. It gets to 4-2 when the board goes up to say, I think it was 6 minutes of injury time. There's this huge roar. The Wolves fans thought they had a decent chance of drawing that game. Chelsea are hopeless defensively. And it's the switch to the three at the back. I mean, maybe it's the three at the back, if Kante then comes in front of that, maybe that will work. But they're unbelievably open. I sort of spin it the other way to round to how you're putting it. I think the fact that academy graduates have scored all their goals, the fact they have a manager who has got such a great history with the club and is so popular with fans, is papering over a wealth of cracks. I don't think you want to be a Chelsea fan at the moment. I mean, maybe City would be happier, I don't know, if Steve Lomas was their manager or something. But
I can see why they're happy, though, Jonathan. Yeah, I take all those points. They're valid. But it's not Lampard's fault that there's a transfer ban. And we mightn't see so much of Mason Mount or Tammy Abraham if there hadn't been this transfer ban. And this is the one thing these Chelsea fans haven't had in this era of unparalleled success over the last 15, 20 years. They actually haven't seen a bunch of young players come through together, or virtually any young players come through at all. So it's going to be exciting. If I'm a Chelsea fan, I'm pretty excited with seeing Tammy Abraham score a hat-trick, for example.
Yeah, sure. And Tammy Abraham was absolutely superb on Saturday. As Frank Lampard said in pretty much every interview, they're three very different types of goals. I think that there'd been sort of a little bit of grumbling about Connor Cody not getting in the England squad for the games against Bulgaria and Kosovo. Well, yeah, we saw why on Saturday. Abraham absolutely destroyed him. So, yeah, they are playing brilliantly. Don't get me wrong. And the fact that, you know, as I think all of us have written a million times, the last player, last Chelsea academy product to become a first team fixture was John Terry, who made his debut in 98. Mm. So this is something refreshing. It does make you wonder who might have been missed in that 20-year period when they refused to pick any academy players. But yeah, I still think there's some... Yeah, there's going to be a Lampard reckoning at some point. Mm.
Okay. What do you make of that, Sam, then, just to finish? I mean, we started off here speaking about City and how, you know, the support injury is going to be a problem for them. Stones and Otamendi, maybe Fernandinho could be a solution. Are there other solutions? Is there a Rashford-type breaker from the sort of youth sides at Manchester City? Is there somebody who could come in and give Guardiola the options that he, at least until the winter transfer window, seems desperately short of in defence?
Yeah, well, I mean, there are some. Eric Garcia, he was the relatively short centre-back I referenced earlier, talking about how he can get an advantage in the air. He's fantastic. They got him from Barcelona a couple of years ago. He's 18 or 19. He is really good. I'm sure he's going to have a really good career in football. I wouldn't be surprised if he was at City. They've also got a young lad called Taylor Harwood-Bellis, who's a bit more of that Rashford character because he's local. He wasn't known too much to Guardiola before the summer, but he went on the pre-season tour and he did really well. So they would be the two names, but whether they're going to get a chance or not, you know, people ask me this quite often. And it ties into the Chelsea stuff a little bit, and I don't think they're going to. Basically, I think, you know, full credit to Lampard because there's an element that his hands are tied with the transfer ban, but he doesn't have to play Abraham. You know, he's got Giroud and Batshuayi, and he doesn't have to play Mount. He could play Barkley. And people like this are genuinely fair play to him for this. I think the difference with Guardiola is I'm convinced that his whole career is generally... I think he's just terrified of losing a game. And that's why he puts so much work into it. That's why he works on every single detail, you know, defensive throw-ins to body positioning, all of that, because I think he's just terrified of any little detail going against his team. And that's why I don't think he plays Foden, because like I say, there's players who are better than him. And maybe Foden's development is suffering to an extent and he's not getting as much experience, but Guardiola's winning games and he's therefore happy. So those centre-backs, unless there's other injuries, I really can't see them coming into the team. There's probably going to be an opportunity, I'd imagine, for Garcia when they play Preston next week in the League Cup. But unless it goes especially well and it goes especially badly for Stones and Otamendi and maybe even Fernandinho, I don't see them coming in. I do think Fernandinho is going to be used very soon. I was surprised he didn't play at the weekend, but maybe Guardiola was going with the confidence thing of saying, well, we do trust Stones, we do trust Otamendi. Mm-hmm. Let's go with it. But I think after they kind of repaid that faith in the way that they did, I wouldn't be surprised at all if Fernandinho became the mainstay in the defence soon enough. And obviously you've got fullbacks, you've got Mendy coming back soon and Cancelo, I would say, just about ready to come in. He might even play in Europe this week. So the defence is going to have a new look to it soon enough. It's just how you protect that heart of it. And I think Fernandinho, if he plays centre-back, he's going to be more reliable, I think, in the face of pressure and being exposed. And then it's just a case of Rodri continuing to improve and not letting himself get bypassed, even if it's just on one or two occasions in games, which it pretty much has been in the first four or five this season.
Great stuff, guys. I, for one, am looking forward to the Steve Lomas era beginning sooner rather than later at Manchester City. Jonathan Wilson, Sam Lee, brilliant stuff. Thanks a mil.
For fuck's sake.
We need to get back to facts here because there seems to be a bit of emotion creeping in. What you've just said really isn't true.
Well, no. No, what I said... I'm not saying...
I don't know what you're saying, to be honest with you.
Okay.
I
mean,
all I make this point.
If you found someone on the street...
Or you interview me. He's a goat, he's a god, he's a
man, he's a guru. You cheeky bastard. You're one Mark
microscopic cog in his catastrophic plan, designed and directed by his red right hand.
I've heard, let me finish. What happened to Chelsea?
For fuck's sake.
Well, this is going splendidly, everybody.
Put the cameras up if you want, let's have a chat. Everybody would think that the appointment of Jose Mourinho would have been a great appointment for Manchester United to win trophies. That they would win trophies under Jose Mourinho.
Well, I don't think everybody would have thought that, but I think somebody who didn't know a lot about football would have thought that.
What, Manchester United? Jose Mourinho?
Yeah.
You cheeky bastard. For fuck's sake. You cheeky bastard. For fuck's sake. You cheeky bastard. For fuck's sake.
I'm intrigued as to what a Frank Lampard reckoning would look like. It certainly doesn't sound like Jonathan Wilson is too confident that this love-in is going to continue indefinitely.
Well,
but for now, they might as well enjoy it.
Yeah. Well, he's a Ramoner, isn't he, Jonathan? you know, I don't know if he, I don't know if he really understands the sort of the bigger picture here,
which is
that the standards have changed. Guardiola is not being judged by the same standards as Frank Lampard. Lampard is not. You can't compare Lampard to what previous Chelsea managers have been judged by. Chelsea supporters would rather see this than, for instance, Mourinho's title-winning 14-15 season. I honestly believe.
You don't honestly believe it, Donny.
Oh, I really do. I honestly believe it.
Not his first title-winning season, though. I mean, they enjoyed that.
Oh, yeah. Well, that was the first title that they'd won since, what, 1955 or something.
And they were
like
scoring goals back then, too.
Yeah, they had a good team. But, you know, I think after, many years of that, they're sort of enjoying this idea of, English saplings all growing up into a mighty Sherwood Forest. I mean, how things are going to go, what a reckoning would look like for Lampard, I can't even imagine it at this point. I mean, I suppose a run of heavy defeats.
Which will happen at some point, as it does to every coach, really.
Yeah, but you know, I do think it's interesting. You know, when you look around, you see a lot of the clubs are sort of doing this at the moment, and the payoff always seems to make it worth it. You know what I mean? Norwich team that beat City the other day had lots of kind of youth players. Obviously, Manchester United have decided consciously to try and go this way a little bit more than say, let's sign Angel Di Maria. You know what I mean? It's more this sort of approach, and. Yeah,
so England for the English, it works, let's go for it. That's what
now
you're saying.
Now we hold. We do not give in.
Well, no,
we do not allow them to score.
But you do, you do have to take into account what fans actually want to see. And this is like, it's clear that this works for Chelsea. And, you know.
So no continental European footballers, but broader Japanese, American...
I'm not saying
Brazilian footballers. All good.
That.
French, Spanish, no Germans.
It just goes
no Germans whatsoever in the Premier League.
It just shows that if you Rudiger's okay. I think the clubs have been doing too little of this in recent years. You know, in terms of the gap to first team is too big. Like remember Jose in the first day of the season. Oh, if you pick Tammy Abraham, you know then. You're telling, it's a signal to everyone, yeah, this is all a load of nonsense. That was honestly his attitude. He just thought, nah, you can't pick Tammy Abraham.
Well, essentially, what he was saying was that Lampard is giving himself a get out if the season doesn't go well by saying, look, I'm investing in youth. That was essentially, as opposed to sticking with Giroud.
As opposed to Lampard saying or thinking to himself, I honestly think this guy is going to be better than Giroud. Sure, that might not be apparent immediately or in the first 10 minutes or whatever it was Jose said he takes to make up his mind about a new player. 10 minutes of watching them stand in the field tells me if they've got it or not. Actually, Lampard is like, well, you know, okay. And after the Manchester United game, maybe that was a game for Giroud, who knows. But the payoff is here. You know, Chelsea have kind of, for the first time in a very long time, kind of are creating one of their own stars. And he's not even the only one in the team. So, I think that explains why people are happy, despite the fact that the results, okay, the win against Wolves notwithstanding, have actually been, you know, mediocre enough.
Champions League on this week, right?
Yes.
Excellent. Okay, well, lots of good stuff coming up on the World Service and over the next few days. That's pretty much it for this show.
Great to be back. Thanks, guys. Thanks, Murph. Thanks,
it's great to have you back on as well. Lovely to say. Back.
Thanks so much.
What is that? That's the second time it's gone off. They never go home. They never go home. They never go home, those boys.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.